The GAA Hour is sponsored by Paddy Power. For exclusive content from their GAA ambassadors and other high-profile contributors, check out news.paddypower.com.
I'm not finished yet. It took me a long time to get here.
Both parents have spoken with each other, and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other, and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
But these fellas, they get such a f***ing shit shock next Saturday evening that we put them back in their f***ing asses for f***ing 10 years.
Welcome to the GR on a Thursday. Connor and Conan are here in studio with me as usual. And sure, we'll start with this Mayo thing, lads, because I'm getting a little bit gassed out with it. And we'll have a say on just, I suppose, that press conference, then the county board statement. And I think this has brought a wrap pretty much this week to this whole story, unless there's some more stuff to come out of it.
There wasn't more stuff from the press conference, so I don't see what more stuff could really come out.
I mean, that's the thing. Now, I know there was 70 minutes recorded, and there's only 40 minutes have seen the light of day, so we don't know what was in the other 30 minutes, but the what's come out in the 40 minutes has been like unimpressive if you're talking about unsafe, unhealthy, personal and sensitive, and then you're talking about how your mental health has been affected. I think that's cynical. I think the language that's been used has been very, very dangerous. And for me, who have been involved in teams and panels and fallen out with managers all my life since I was 12, there's nothing in anything that they've said. You come across managers that bark, you come across managers that are like best friends with the players, you come across managers that standoffish, and this is all experience. This is how you deal with this. Some managers might tell you very blunt with you. That's a management style. It's not supposed to make you feel unsafe. It's not supposed to be personal and sensitive. So you have Sarah Tierney, the captain. So she did a lot of talking at it, and she tried to paint a picture of how Peter and her relationship were. Now, you have to give context to this whole thing. It's fair to say that for a good few years, there's been a core leadership within that Mayo panel that have pretty much ran the show. Like, I mean, that's the information I have. So when you're looking at Peter coming in here, he's trying to break up that kind of power group, and he's trying to give everybody the same kind of, you know, standing in the panel. The younger girls not to feel a little bit intimidated, but maybe by the girls with all stars or by these great players. So maybe he's coming down a little bit harder on these girls if they're trying to run the show, like maybe they're used to. So, like, I mean, I'm trying to understand this. So Sarah Tierney, kind of in her own defense, gives a couple of anecdotes that I'm like, Sarah, This is not should not be said to defend yourself. Like, this is actually playing into Peter Leahy's hands. Like, this is not a defense. Now, the first one I'm a little bit kind of more relaxed about, because I've seen players say things like this, and they definitely say it amongst themselves. So she comes back to the panel late. She's an all-star defender. On my first night back, the majority of the training was all running. I made a passing comment to him like, Jesus, Peter, it's going to be all running tonight, or will there be any football? I didn't mean anything malicious by it. It's not my character. The following night, I received a phone call from Peter about the comment I made, and he basically attacked me on the phone. Now, her account of it is that Peter says you can F your all-stars and all this kind of thing. I thought that was very, very over the top from Peter. I rang him about it, and he's completely denied that he said anything like that. So you have to take who you believe in that scenario, whether it be Peter or Sarah. He said the other story she told about what he said to her after the next one we'll get to, he said that's true, but he said under no circumstances, because I was thinking, well, she has no business saying that in front of people. She's overstepping the mark to be saying put your fucking all-stars wherever you want. I thought that was too much. He says he didn't do that. So anyways,
I don't think he has to defend that though either. Like, that's, you know, like, some managers say things. If he did say that, it just means he's not great with people.
Bit of an asshole, I would say. Like, that's what, like, you know, I'd say you've said I didn't deserve that. It was a bit of an outburst, but again,
trial for being an asshole.
Exactly, you know? He's not on trial for being an asshole. So, like, I mean, this is the thing. How many of us down through the years have always come out of the dressing room and we see cones set up, and we're like, oh Jesus! And you talk amongst yourselves, and you'd ask yourselves, here, anyone see any footballs? No, oh, for you're livid, you're pissed off. But you're not supposed to say that to the manager, because that's overstepping the mark. And again, you have to remember the context of there being a leadership group that have kind of ran the show and maybe overstepped the marks, and Leahy's trying to stop this. So of course he's going to come down hard on that.
It was her first night back as well. She'd been doing exams, so she just came in. So he might have been thinking, where are you coming from on this as well? So take that into account too.
It hadn't been said before. So then this is the worst one. So again, this is her giving an example of this in her own defense, like trying to paint Peter in a bad light. So he said, we had a training in Rochford Bridge up the country. At the end of training, everyone had gone, and I went up to Peter to say that we had an issue in the backs all season. In the league, we've been conceding high scores. I said, I think there's a massive communication issue here, and if we can get a past player to come in as a player or a guest coach to talk us through a few things, that would add value to the setup. Now, that is the height of cheek, right? So let's actually break down what she's gone to the manager. Now, you have to remember, Mayo made the league final. They're doing grand. Yeah. They're conceding. The information is that Sarah Tierney was conceding a lot of scores. So there's a lot of self-preservation here. But to go to a manager and say, can we get a past player in as a guest coach? It's the ultimate insult. It's like, Peter, you're not able to tactically set up a defence, and I want some past player. Imagine saying that to Mourinho. You know, like, yeah. I mean, you haven't played at the highest level, so you can't actually do this. She wouldn't be my captain anymore if that's the kind of stuff she takes. But it's just, she's saying this in her defence.
Yeah.
It just goes to show how normalised these girls' contributions were, yeah, with management, that they think they can go to a manager and say, you're not doing this right, I know better.
Was there a mix-up in words there? Because, like, I heard her say this at the press conference as well, that getting a guest pass player in as a player... Or did she?
She said as a player or as a coach?
I think she meant a coach.
Maybe there was nerves there.
The fact that she didn't realise that she was overstepping her boundaries there would make me a bit worried about the kind of control that they might have exerted before Peter Leahy came in.
That's exactly how I read it.
Yeah, because any manager is bound to take offence to that. It's a direct insult to your coaching thus far, and probably, as you said, self preservation, kind of sparing yourself from the blame for what's gone before.
And Just quickly, because I was reading Malachy Clerkin had a good piece on this, and he went down hard on both kind of sides and thought Leahy was a poor manager. And he said, all the best practice in running a sports team these days talks about a player-centred approach, facilitation, enabling players to express the best of themselves, all that good stuff. And he's right. But enabling players, like, a manager should always enable players and get their feedback when he asks for it. This is not an open invitation to come and tell the manager that he's doing wrong. That's not a healthy panel. There has to be manager-player. And absolutely agree with Malachy that managers should always pick the brains of players and say, what do you think of this? We're thinking of doing this. But that's when they're open to these suggestions. There's a completely different thing to go to Jim Gavin and say, Jim, because I know Jim Gavin is an open manager and gets feedback from players, but they don't overstep the mark by going to him and saying, this isn't right, because then you're completely overstepping the line.
Yeah, and once again, his style of coaching isn't what we're talking about. Like, this is a national story because someone went on a national radio station and said the environment he created wasn't safe and it wasn't healthy. It's a national story because of these very public complaints, and people started making assumptions then because they didn't specify what happened. This is why everyone's talking about it. There were innuendos. People started jumping to conclusions, awful conclusions. Yeah. If this was about his style of coaching, we would just be talking about whether he's a bad manager or a good manager, and that's it.
Yeah.
Like, we would just leave it at that. Not that he's a bully or aggressive to women, which I've heard, or any of this nonsense.
If they came out and said, look, he's a shit manager, we're not interested in it, we'll wait until a new manager comes in, you'd say, alright, that's fair enough, move on, there's nothing else to see here. Because Fiona McHale was saying that she was talking about a player being called lazy, another being told they weren't committed, even though they've been at every training bar one. But being at every training doesn't mean you're committed. Yeah, it means that you have a good attendance record at training. Yeah, that's not commitment.
Yeah. Like, you're complaining about sprints the whole time.
Like, yeah. And at the end of every group in the long runs, just because I'm there and I'm ticking every box, that's commitment. That's completely got it all twisted. But interestingly, you see on Twitter, there's a girl, Laura Newman, who's played under Leahy for Westmead, won an intermediate All-Ireland with him. And she's been very strong in her defence of Leahy. And I think she's a very kind of objective person to talk about this, because there's obviously a side that everyone's forgetting in the whole Mayo thing, and that's the girls that stayed and backed the manager, because this is being sold as a players versus Peter Leahy thing. It's not. It's a players that dropped off who are the minority versus the manager versus their colleagues that stayed and versus the county board. So realistically, this is not a 50-50 us versus them. This is 12 players that are completely the minority in comparison to who they're actually going against.
Yeah,
who
and eight from the same club.
And eight from the same club. There you go. Yeah. Like, I mean, that's, you know, it's not the same thing. So Laura tweeted, I have to agree with this. She says, having played with him and winning in All-Ireland, I can tell you he is without doubt a very good manager. This is in reply to Malachy Clerkin's piece, who Malachy was obviously, like I explained, taking the point that he's obviously not, you know, much of a manager. But she said, I have to agree with this. Having played with him Having played under him winning in All-Ireland, I can tell you he was without doubt a very good manager. Maybe people just flourish under different styles of management. We certainly did in Westmead. And then she retweets Ewan McKenna's piece, which was outstanding again last night. Ewan's on a roll. Like, I mean, he's he's what a signing for the Independent. Like, I mean, he's essential reading every Thursday now. Like, you look forward to his pieces because they're so good. And the great thing about Ewan, he doesn't follow that PC agenda that the media, that they're all scared to go against this. It's terrible. It's rife throughout the media. It's so easy to jump on the other side. Ewan is an independent thinker and I love him for it, and he doesn't care. And he always, what he says is actually right.
Yeah.
He's just not going along with the easy, you know what I mean? The easy narrative. But anyways, we'll give you a quote out of Ewan's piece just to wrap this up. He says, so she says, this 100 times over, this is Laura Newman. And just a reminder that he won an All-Ireland with a team who 2 years previous had been in relegation to go down to junior. You just don't get there without being a good manager. So, that's a big statement from her, from a Westmead perspective, who kind of is acknowledging his style by saying maybe people just flourish under different styles of management.
Yeah.
And she's clearly saying there's nothing wrong with this.
Yeah, and even I was going back, I saw a quote from Sarah Rowe there during the summer as well. Said she was very happy. He said he was tough. She said tough three times, but said job as a coach, always give constructive criticism, only made us stronger and better players.
Yeah.
Which just, that's, you know, it's the carrot and the stick approach. Some respond better to the stick, some respond better to the carrot. In this case, the majority of the panel responded better to kind of Leahy's style of management. I have to say, after the press conference, I did have a little bit of sympathy for Sarah Tierney, because she did get a little upset when talking about that one particular meeting with Peter Leahy. She said she's never been more intimidated in her life, drove home from training afterwards and said she'd never meet him again in a one-on-one situation without the player liaison officer. Then she said she was crying. She said, I felt I had no other decision to walk away from Mayo Football. And you can't underestimate the fact how big a decision that was.
You see, she didn't leave for that, though.
I know.
She left after Carnacon. So, if I would find that more believable if she went, I'm leaving the panel now, because that conversation just was out of order. But she waited until the other eight left and then given, like, you know what I mean?
But that incident in and of itself, for her to feel that upset about it and then eventually leading to her walking away. She's been with the senior team since she was 15. But what it boiled down to is that it still didn't, as upsetting as it was for Sarah Tierney, it still didn't boil down to the unsafe or unhealthy environment that they were saying that was the reason why they left the panel.
And that's the thing. And if a girl's crying, you're obviously going to have sympathy and whatever. But, like, I mean, being intimidated is subjective.
What I'm intimidated
by, somebody else might go, Jesus. You know what I mean? So where do you stop on this? You have to say, was she intimidated? Yes. Should she have? Would someone else? Is he being intimidating? So, you know what I mean?
That's
the difference.
Yeah,
that's the difference here.
And most importantly, like, as you said, she did have the option just to walk away. He's the manager. Yeah. Like, you spoke about Mikko and feeling isolated under him in your piece, Willie. And, like, you know, that happens. And how many people this year have left panels? They don't like the manager. They're not getting a look in. And they just leave. Like, we don't need to go through the national press to talk about why you left.
With the vague innuendos, and then the mental health stuff. Health stuff mentioned before this thing. So, what was interesting was whether the mental health was caused by Peter Leahy or whether the mental health issues was caused by the backlash they received on Twitter. We don't know. Or do they have mental health issues? Again, if you're talking about unsafe, if you're talking about personal and sensitive, all this innuendo, and then you pull mental health out, it's another one of those, whoa, you know what I mean? Better not go near that.
You can't be flippant about mental health.
Can't.
But the thing is, I didn't like how mental health was ascribed to a group of 14 players. Surely mental health is something, I'm no expert in the issue, but surely mental health is something that's individual. And can you just so easily ascribe it to a group of 14 players? I didn't like it like that, and it made it more difficult to analyse it, and it made the situation more complicated and messy than I think it had to be, than it already was, and it was already very bad as well.
Yeah. My take is that it was a cynical thing to say, but, like, I mean, we don't know, because, like, our mental health, like, are you just throwing mental health onto abuse at Twitter? Like, mental health is a very, very serious illness.
Yes, of course.
It's not, I felt annoyed, frustrated, sad. That's not mental health. That's what you feel when you're reading stuff that you don't like. Do you know what I mean? I think to ascribe mental health to that was wrong. It was, and it was a cheap one. But anyways, we'll leave the last word to Hugh McKenna, who's obviously did an outstanding piece. He says, it makes this Mayo episode symptomatic of a wider pick and miss form of gender equality. That we share everything, but you pay for dinner mentality, which was a good one. Parity is just when it suits. And while women in sport have been fighting hard for that parity, clearly on this occasion, it didn't suit some. So do you want to be treated like a men's team? Do you want a male manager? Are you going to talk about feelings? Are you going to get upset? Is it supposed to be equal? Or does a male manager have to come into a ladies' team like Mayo and not be himself, not be how he would act with a men's team, even like the Westmead ladies' team? So maybe it's not even a fair comment about gender equality. He's just being the manager that he is. And he's having unsafe personal sense of all these horrible things thrown at him. And like, you can't, like Ewan says, you can't call for parity when it suits you. Like, I mean, that's the reality of it. And I don't think these Mayo ladies have done anybody a service out of all this. So we'll move on from that, lads, because we've probably talked way too much about it altogether. So there's been an ERSI study commissioned by the GEA and the GPA. So this has come out this week, and it used data from a 2016 survey. So some of the results from the study have found that a player can spend up to 31 hours per week on their senior intercounty commitments. They comprised on personal relationships and general downtime to make time to play intercounty football or hurling. Like, I mean, 31 hours per week, now that has to be the most extreme level. Like, I mean, that divided by 7 is like just over 4 hours per day. So, like, I mean, obviously commutes, that's okay if you would maybe believe that for someone from Mayo driving working in Dublin, driving back would be believable. But someone from Port Laois playing with the Laois team, training in Port Laois, you're not going to be anywhere near that 31 hours mark. But it does give an idea of the amount of time that's going in outside of working hours, and how some players are choosing careers to suit that type of commitment.
Yeah, like, it depends sort of what John Sugary has in store for the Laois guys. Though they might be end up getting up to 31 hours. Like, I think, like, a lot of this report is talking about players walking away and, you know, sort of maybe not handling the commitment. But again, I sort of almost bring that back to what we were just talking about. It's like, this is the deal. It's tough work. If you want to be a county star, if you want to play at the top level, be a league sportsman.
Should it be that much tough work?
Yeah, it's an awful lot. It's almost a second job, I suppose, on top of it all, 31 hours. But that's what it is. Some managers are going to come in and say, listen, this is what I need to do to get Sam Maguire.
That's the thing. And this is what they're talking about. So just another key finding was the players compromise on sleep, and almost half of those surveys are not getting the 8 to 10 hours sleep. Jeez, I'd only be too delighted with 8 to 10 hours. What about having children?
Hey.
Where does that fit in? Jeez, 8 to 10 hours is fairy tale stuff. I don't know when's the last time I've had that. Yeah. But, like, I mean, this is the thing. It is the walking away thing. But one of the solutions that's coming out of this from the GPA is that there's a player welfare officer in each county board, and they're independent, and they're taking that power away from the intercounty managers. Because the thing about this is that managers will try to flog them, and managers will have loads of training sessions if they're getting paid by the training session. Like, I mean, that's happening at club level. So do you take that power off them and say, hang on a minute, that's too many hours in a week, that's not that, you know, that player's welfare is at say, and not kind of be independent from the county board, who seem to be kind of at the mercy of intercounty managers?
So would the GAA appoint 32 independent player welfare officers, or would it be like a selection of player welfare officers that visit every county and are kind of accountable for the practice across the board? Is that it?
Like, yeah, it was more of a suggestion from, you know, rather than actually, it was from Seamus Hickey, I think, and it was like a national one, and then kind of, you know, different county boards then have their... My thoughts are is that every county board should have an independent CEO with a business background, and he looks after all this stuff. Like, I mean, you know, that he's maybe not from that county, so he's not as emotionally invested in if a manager says, if we don't do this, we won't win. I don't care, you're not doing it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I would love to see a player actually just put up their actual week, you know, rather than just for training this. Just, I think Mark Wahlberg's Instagram story there, where he laid out exactly what his day was. Just like going to the gym at 6 o'clock, but had to leave at 5:30 or whatever, so then you could actually accumulate all these hours. Because I'm sure, you know, during January and February, they might be in the gym 4 times, which might amount to 8 hours of this 31 hours. They'd probably be in the gym anyway. Do you know? So
as a hobby, yeah.
So sometimes it probably doesn't feel as much as a big commitment than what it would be. I would love to see just a whole week later.
Or is a solution to, like, well, we're talking about condensing the season anyway, but to condense the season so that if it is going to be 30 to 31 hours a week, that it's only for X months of a year, and then that you have, there's going to be 6 months then that you're obviously not going to be spending that amount of time, because it all comes back to, the argument is still going to be, well, Dublin did more this year, we need to do more next year. And the only reason the only way we can do that is spending more time in the gym, more time in the training pitch. And like, best of luck to the player welfare officer telling the county, but telling somebody in the management that they can't, that you're not allowed to do it, because I've been told that this is the guidelines that we've been serving, you can't do it. So.
Yeah, it's not an easy fix. Yeah. It's definitely not an easy fix, but it's an interesting one. John Horan is kind of leading this. He gave anecdotal evidence of players telling him they chose to be teachers until such time as their intercounty careers are over. He says, maybe we need to look, see if we can identify someone who, in a neutral way, could influence what commitment is there for the players. It's not an easy fix. He says, if we leave it to managers, some managers could be the greatest club men when they're with the club. All of a sudden, they become a different character when they're with the county and tell players not to play with their clubs. And we see that all the time.
Yeah,
like, I
100%.
Mean, Jim McGuinness is an example of that. He's a great Glenties man, a Glenties manager, won a county title with him, then gets in with the county and bans them from playing with the clubs. Do you know what I mean? This happens all over the place. And that's quite, like, I don't criticise him for that. He's a winner and they don't mix. They're completely different levels, so I can see where he was coming from on it. So maybe it's something to look out for.
It happens at club level as well. It is seeping down. Like, I remember we had a manager from Glenties, Paddy Campbell, and we had to send, like, if anybody was going to Belfast for college or work, he would sort of come up to them and be like, what's wrong with you? I can get you a job down here. I'll get you a job. Hey, like, you know, so then he would just have boys where he wanted boys sort of working close to training, so their life would be a bit easier. But that was just all focused around club intermediate football.
Right.
Like, you know, so it's sort of seeping down anyway into club level. And again, it's sort of what Connor says, is people wanting to just do more than the other team, and maybe they will just keep doing that and there's no way of stopping it.
It's just never stop. It's never ends. Yeah. Will it get to a point in 4 or 5 years where a manager says, you're going to have to give up that job? You'll go on the dole because I need you. Now, do you want to win in All-Ireland? It's up to yourselves, lads. Yeah. It's up to yourselves. You make the decision. Yeah. You want to win in All-Ireland, give up your job, or you want to keep that stupid job and we've no chance.
That'll be when you're managing the team, and then there'll be a press conference of players saying they didn't feel safe in the environment with William in charge.
Social welfare payments will be out the door. Right, Allianz Hurling Leagues could have a new look by 2020. So this is just quickly, I'll touch on this. So John Horan is talking about revamping Division 1A and 1B, because we know in the hurling, the Division 1A is a shark tank and Division 1B is nice and relaxed and easy, and the last two All-Ireland champions, Limerick and Galway, have come out of 1B. So always the talk was you have to be in 1A for competitive games. And now people are realising, Jesus, in 1B you can try loads of players out. You can take it nice and easy and build your year up, while in 1A you have to start with your first 15 and secure your place in Division 1, and you're hitting the ground in February almost at championship intensity. So he's going to combine the two. Instead of having four teams in relegation, he's just going to have the bottom two teams. So you've less problem with relegation. So what's going to happen with this is that the National League in hurling, and they're looking to do this in 2020, and I call this in the hurling show, lads, you might not even see this, so this is actually leading in, it's just going to be a warm-up competition for the championship, and that's the reality. It's going to be, try out your panel, it's going to be what the January competitions are, just a bit longer. So the league could take on much less significance. Relegation is not going to be a threat, because there'd be a leash, or there'd be a, you know, one of the weaker teams coming up and down, you know, so the stronger teams will never really have a problem with relegation. They'll try out their panels, they'll get loads sorted out, and then bang, into the Munster and Leinster leagues. So it's just going to be one big pre-season tournament.
Yeah.
Again,
that's been sold as a good thing, though. That's what they kind of want it to be, is a development for, and because the championship now is so packed in hurling, that maybe there's a case to be, like, I don't know, I think it'd be better if the leagues were more competitive. But when the championship starts in May and there's so many games and
the championship is a league now, and that was the point I was making on the hurling show, that when the championship's a league, what is the league? Who really gives a shit about that? Because the league is starting, so you go from a league to a league. So the Championship League is going to, you know, outshine the league.
That's why your football championship proposal is so flawed.
No, there's only, that's part of the championship. That's the thing.
The league is a warm up anyway, isn't it? Like in every,
I suppose second. It is. When hurling, it hadn't been for the last few years because Kilkenny, Tip, and these teams were winning the All Ireland, coming out of that competitiveness, and the narrative and the analysis was you need to be in this, and this is why they're winning because they're getting those, you know, great games, and you know that's probably the way they're looking at it.
I just don't know, like, this is hurling, but I always remember Fintan Kelly's thing this year after they beat Monaghan, beat Tyrone, and this was a few games left, and he said, "Oh, now we can concentrate on the championship." And it's like, what? What's the point of being in Division 1A if the only point is to stay there for next year, and you're not really trying to win it anyway? It's just as soon as you're in it, you're trying to get to a stage where you don't care about it, you know, so you can focus on the championship.
But isn't that how most a lot of teams are thinking? You know, at the moment, there's only a couple of teams that have a genuine ambition to win the league at the start of the year, and the ambition for the rest of them is just to stay there because relegation from Division 1 would be such a disaster.
But why is it a disaster if you don't care about it?
Well, I don't know. I'm just saying that's the way it is at the moment. I know Mayo, for example, is just the aim has been survival because it's been the team is kind of aging. There's been a lot of injuries, and just get through the league, stay in Division 1, and then prime yourself a championship.
I take your point. I think it's a psychological thing. If you're relegated, you're having a terrible year, and it feeds into the Jesus, we're not going well, lads. You know, and we're not in the top division. I think it's more of a psychological thing than anything else. Let's make sure we're not relegated because the relegated teams can't bounce back for the championship. Although I think Donegal did
won the Ulster this year.
Yeah, when they were relegated, I think they did on McGuinness as well. Or no, maybe they won. Did they win the All Ireland coming out of Division Two? I'm not sure. Oh, they won Ulster coming out of Division Two.
Yeah.
Anyways, right. The big news in Mayo, Connor, is James Horan's club, Ballintubber, have nominated him. John Fogarty tweeted this: James Horan's club, Ballintubber, have nominated him to succeed Stephen Rochford. Nomination given with Horan's approval.
Yeah.
So Horan hasn't really come out to, he's been vague and often non-committal about whether he's back in the mix, but Horan's back in the mix. How's this being received? So there's two names in the mix, so there's only two can get it now, and I thought these were going to be on the same ticket potentially, but they're going head to head. Is that fair enough? So Mike's Solon.
I don't know, has it been ruled out? Well, maybe that does rule it out if they're going head to head.
They're the only two nominations.
Yeah.
So they haven't been nominated as, do you have to nominate them on the same ticket? I'm not sure the politics of that.
The nomination process works, because I know the idea had been floated that Michael Solon would potentially come on board as part of James Horan's ticket, that he'd learn the ropes under James Horan, and then potentially in a few years, having served the apprenticeship with the under-20s and the under-21s, won at Ireland with the 21s in 2016, that he might be ready to take on the senior job. But I think the thing with James Horan, ever since his name has been mooted, is that while he hasn't been committed, he hasn't ruled it out immediately. If he didn't want the job, he would have said immediately that he didn't want it, and he was leaving it up in the air. So kind of Mayo people are getting excited about the prospect of him coming back. The only thing about James Horan coming back, the elephant in the room has been his relationship with the county board that was pretty sour in the last couple of years when he was in charge the first time. So how have the county board kind of reacted to the possibility of him coming back on again? Purely from a fan's point of view, I'd welcome him back in a heartbeat. I think that,
and that would be the general consensus.
I think so. Like, the only reason why it mightn't be the general consensus is, oh, it's another fate, why can't we get somebody new? But like, why would you want somebody new when he completely transformed the culture of Mayo football? He's been, while as like he's been still managing club level, he's been in tune with kind of the modern day football with his pundit roles with Sky Sports, etc. I'm pretty sure that all the players would welcome him back on board. And just, I think he personally would probably relish a shot with this bunch of players that he worked with for so long, that if they are going to have another tilt at Dublin, the time is running out, and I think in the next couple of years he'll relish that shot. So I think kind of in Mayo there was a feeling for a while that he had gone off the prospect of the job, and that there was mooting of Jack O'Connor and stuff like that. But I think as soon as his name was mentioned at the start as a live possibility, I think it's going to be welcomed. I hope he gets it.
Right. Okay. Seems to be the popular one, Conan. Anything to say on this?
Where's Kevin McStay? Why has he just been ruled out altogether?
I think Kevin McStay maybe has been burned and he's kind of done. He has to be nominated. Like, so if Kevin McStay wanted to be nominated, he would get nominated.
McStay retired from inter-county management in a statement for Roscommon.
Done, Conan. Get with the program.
Different Mayo's different to Roscommon.
Let's nominate a fella who's retired. That's a great. Make sure I don't have you on a selection committee for the Lex Leash manager. Pádraig Fanning, lads. We have a couple more to get through. Pádraig Fanning, someone I didn't know very much about, is the new Waterford hurling manager. So it's a fantastic job. He's not a household name. His hurling career was hampered by a bad leg break at an early stage. He did captain Waterford RTC. This is before it was an IT. I was back there when it was an RTC in 1996. Dropped out of there after 2 months. Anyways, we won't get into that. But he was, so he was on Davy Fitzgerald's backroom team. So he's worked on Davy Fitzgerald's backroom team with both Waterford and Wexford. And he was in with Cheddar in Leash for a couple of years. So listen, he's, if he learned anything from Cheddar, he's gone fairly well. And Davy Fitzgerald, obviously a brilliant mentor as well. So he's 47 and he reckons that if it's not the right time now, it's never going to be. So he's been around the modern game. And we know the system Davy Fitzgerald prefers, so it'll be interesting to see what he comes to Waterford with, whether he has a new kind of outlook on it. But I thought it was an interesting comment that he made. He says, this is on Davy and what he learned from Davy. So he says, the way he manages players, individuals, he's a Superman manager and he's tactically very astute. I used to be in charge of the B's versus the A's in the A versus B games, and we'd always be trying to get one over on him. Like, I just thought that was a great little quote. Yeah. Like, I mean, this is how competitive Davey is, that his own selectors are going, well, we want to beat this little in an A versus B game. Like, it's a classic.
But he's saying he's only a small little fish after the A versus B game.
Imagine Davey just being livid at the B's. But no, that, like, I mean, that sums up, like, and even that competitive nature in the A versus B's, because too often, like, we might have done that once or twice with Mikko, where the selectors would have got involved being the managers of that, and it felt like two teams. A lot of the time we'd just pick two teams and they'd play A versus B's on the same thing. But if you create a culture that these are two different like you're playing somebody else, these are your enemies, and you have a different manager, and the fact that there's a competitive edge between Fanning and Davy, this is a brilliant A versus, this goes from just being an A versus B game into a bloody proper game.
Yeah.
Like, indeed, like, they're so competitive. Like, you can even picture Fanning and Davy mounting at each other on the line. Like, I mean, and they're trying to pull tactical moves out of the, it's just brilliant. I love that kind of stuff. And, like, I mean, you know, just, it transforms A versus B's into completely different games. John Sugrue, can't say enough good stuff about John Sugrue. So John Sugrue has a plan now to introduce divisional football competition, which is going to give potential county stars a chance to impress in competitive fare.
This is brilliant.
So, yeah, so this is Sugrue. So this is the thing. So obviously there's only four teams left in the Leash Championship. There's so many players that are already out, so he can't really see them at the latter stages of the championship, and you can't be at every game in the county. So obviously a manager is not going to see all the club games, and he wants to see all the players. So he's divided Leash into four regions, and competition that he's starting up is going to start the week after the county final, with the county champions being excluded, which will be Port Leash, and he'll know all those players anyway. So this was in the match programme of the last week's quarterfinals. So John Sugrue says, so the proposed trial tournament will be played on a round robin basis, with three games on successive weekends. Top two divisional teams qualify for the cup final, and the bottom two divisional teams play in a shield final on the same weekend. Independent managers will be put in place, and put my hand up to train one of them. Independent management will be put in place for each team, and will hopefully give the players the chance to play in a condensed talent type situation. We'll be narrowing down the panel of players from this, and from there 2019 begins. What we hope is that you come out in numbers and join us on the first step. So he's even asking supporters to come out and support this. It's just a great kind of innovative way of getting your trial games, instead of the same old nonsense and pick two teams. There's going to be four sections of Leash. Just, you know, it's just popped into my head, is if Dublin did this, north, south, west. How did that go, lads? Did you enjoy it? anyways, this is a really good initiative from Sugrue, and, like, I'm a big fan of John Sugrue. We're very lucky to have him, and just a nice little thing to do.
It's class. I think every single county in Ireland, probably outside of Dublin, will be watching this now going, Jesus, we should be doing this.
Like, yeah, many Dublin times? Definitely won't do it, right? I can categorically say it. We'll not split it into four distinct north, south, east, west.
But just to get a big crowd out as well. And, like, how many times do we talk about junior and intermediate players who maybe don't get a look in?
Yeah, that's the thing.
Their chance to play at the very top, like, with a select team from certain regions. I think it's absolutely brilliant. And I think every county should be following in behind us.
Yeah, for trials. Make something out of something that's usually mundane and a little bit boring outside of for the players involved. Four different sets of jerseys, four different different managers and just make a nice little tournament out of something.
I think it'll attract more, potentially more fans than it would for a county semi-final, because people have vested interest to see how their club man is getting on at a divisional level, you know.
Yeah.
And the best thing about this, I'm just thinking about Mayo, like the best thing about this is nobody can ever say that somebody wasn't given a look in anymore. Nobody can say that.
Oh yeah,
this fella's been doing the business in club football for years and he's never been getting a look in. Well, if they don't get a look in a divisional setup with the county divided into four, well then they'll never get a look in again.
So you'd have four 15s, which is 60, then five players coming on. Even at the minimum five subs coming on, you're looking at 80 players in a competitive situation, and then it could be different teams on the next day, and you'd be seeing upwards of 100 players
outside,
you know,
of the county setup and outside the county champions. So you probably have 50 players from the inter-county panel and the county champions, and then another. So that's 100. You're talking a lot of players in the county.
This will live beyond Suguru now as well, like it's created a little tradition here, like Kerry, when you get the regional teams together to take a cut at the big ones.
It's so simple. How is something like this never
possible? The great ideas are always the simple ones, if only we could come up with them. So Macho O'Hanlon, just to finish up, so we've all seen this video, right, in Wexford club football where the cornerback is running to the first look. It's a bit like the Salah video last night. You think, geez, Salah's a spoiled brat, and then you see it again and again and you realise, yeah, he actually did celebrate it. But anyways, so the poor cornerback comes running down, tries to give this physio a shoulder and ends up on his arse, right? So number one, couple of things to say on this. So the physio is actually an ex-Wexford player, or an ex-Wexford player. He's 6'3" and he's 15 stone. This is according to Matty Ford on Twitter. So your man just bounces off him, so that's grand. Now, have to be said that the physio was overstepping the mark with the fullback even before this ever happened. Yeah. He pushed him 100%. And he's no business doing that. So I would have understood if one of the St. James players came, ran down, give him a dunt, and that's what it kind of looked like. But according to Matthew O'Hanlon, he says, that's my club, which is St. James. It's not clear from the video, but what actually happens is our cornerback made a run for a short kick out and was illegally blocked by the physio. As a result, the ref sent off the physio to the stands. So if you actually look at it again, the ball is coming out.
Yeah.
Now, maybe the cornerback saw him and went, I can take him man and ball, and ended up in his arse. I don't know, but he went down so easy, maybe it looked a little bit like he wasn't necessarily looking to see. He can't go down that easy. He's not the bloody wall.
Yeah, he seemed to run into him with his chest as well. I was supposed to run into him with a shoulder. Yeah. When I saw it first, I laughed like everybody because it looked great. Like, and it looked like the fellow was trying to give him a dunt. And only when I saw that line from Matthew Hanlon, that he was running that fast, and the ball is there, and the guy that's running with him goes to pick up the ball and pretend as if the attack goes on afterwards. Yeah. But just how much you said, I 100% agree. My pet peeve is officials or physios or water carriers, whatever, getting involved with players on the pitch. I hate it. And I know it was only a little dunt.
It was nothing, but it's enough to inflame.
It's not your prerogative in any way whatsoever to get involved. Just do what you have to do and get out of there, and don't be a nuisance. So as you said, if somebody did come up and give him a dunt, while it doesn't look great, he would have been entitled to do it, I think.
I think so too. So get your 6'3" frame, 15 stone arse off the field, buddy, and listen. And that's it. Right, we'll come back in part two. We'll talk to Declan McBennett. Come here, I want you to talk us through the goal you scored in the county final after 15 seconds. I want you to tell me when you had goal on your mind.
Yeah, you've probably had a few 15 seconds experiences yourself. Break me off, show me what you got,
because I don't want no one minute. Alright, delighted to say RT's new head of sport, Declan McBennett, joins us in studio now. Declan, how's it going?
Good, thanks, Carl.
We're all very excited here in the GAR because this is a GAA podcast. You're the new head of sport in RTE and you are a GAA man. So you're our great white hope here, Declan. We're going to see more GAA on RTE.
Yeah, well, you got it right there, Colin. I'm head of sport. I come from a GAA background, and I'm very proud of that, and I make no apologies for it. And obviously, it's the game that I'm sort of most familiar with because coming from Monaghan, it is the game in Monaghan. That having been said, I always have to point out to people that I'm head of sport. So, as I've said to others, whether it's Reece McClellan or Shane Ryan or whoever it is that's coming home with a medal, that means as much to us in RT terms as Gaelic Games. Gaelic Games is huge for us. I make no apologies for having a GAA background, but I am head of sport and I have to be representative of that.
Okay, so this is a GAA podcast, so we're just biased for GAA, right? So we're allowed.
You can be.
But right, so like the criticism of RTE is that on the national broadcaster, right, and this was under Ryan Nugent, maybe your predecessor, is that there's only been 4 months of GAA on RTE out of 12. Right. So a lot of people think that's not enough for a national broadcaster to be given as for a national sport. So yeah. I wonder what your thoughts on that are.
Okay, we're straight into the criticism. That's we're off and running. Okay, so this is the third interview that I've done since I got the job as head of sport, and in one of the interviews I said that 80% of the criticism of RTE is based around a lack of information or a lack of understanding, particularly around the rights market that we operate. 10% of the criticism, I think, is perfectly justified, and 10% of it is, quite frankly, off the wall. So in terms of your specific question around GAA for 4 months, yeah, we're the primary player in the GAA market in what used to be the five-month window from May to September and is currently now a four-month window because of the concertina calendar. That's down to rights. No other reason. It's simply down to rights. So you look at the GAA calendar and you can largely split it in three. You've got National League, you've got Championship, and then you've got club towards the end of the year. Ultimately, would I like to be in all three of them? Yes. Ultimately, would I aspire to be in all three of them so that we have a presence across the year? Yes. Currently, on the basis of rights, that's the market that we are in, and we have the Championship rights. Now, I have to say, as well as that, any aspiration to get into the league or indeed the club does not in any way detract from those who are currently in the league and the club and who do an excellent job on the league and the club. But as the national broadcaster, would I like to have a seasonal footprint? Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, because that's the thing, because like obviously Ryan Nugent would be seen as a rugby man, and they're like, obviously it's probably maybe an unfair kind of categorization of him, like he was sport like everybody else, but he is BlackRock, and he's a rugby commentator, and in the recent past, like, there's been Pro 14, there has been Heineken Cup, there has been Six Nations, there's been World Cup, there's been under 20 internationals, there's been women internationals, all rugby. Yet in GAA we've only got Championship, like, you know, like you said. So this is where, you know, people are looking at this going, Jesus, thank God for Declan and Matt Bennett.
That would be a really simplistic interpretation of what is at play. First of all, it's an accident of birth that Ryle is BlackRock or that I'm Monaghan, so that doesn't come into it. Secondly, you called Pro 12 there, which is now Pro 14. It's gone from RTE.
I know you've lost them all, but you've had them.
Heineken, gone from RTE. You know, Six Nations, gone from RTE. Yeah. Because of the rights market, and that's indicative of the rights market that we operate in, because in the same way that there has been a huge fragmentation of the broadcasters, there's been a huge fragmentation of the rights. So in the course of the period of time that I've had the job, I've met with most of the sporting bodies, not all of them, because it's been such a busy summer of sport and various different travel arrangements, what have you, but I've met with the majority of them, and the point that I put to them is the same point that I will probably put to them for as long as I'm in this job, which is there is a balance to be struck for all the sporting organisations between revenue on one side and exposure on the other. Okay, now I fully respect and have to acknowledge that each and every sporting organisation has the absolute right to extract the maximum revenue that it can from its particular rights portfolio in order to reinvest that in the club game or the grassroots structures or whatever terminology you want to use. Equally, there is an argument with regard to exposure. And each rights organisation, each sporting organisation has to make a decision at the end of the day between revenue and exposure. And it's quite hard to marry those at times. So you go behind a paywall, you're probably getting greater revenue. You go behind a paywall, you're almost certainly getting a smaller audience.
Yeah.
So that's the balance that has to be struck by the sporting organisations. Now, from my perspective, there's a further factor, which is a budgetary concern. We're the national broadcaster. We're charged with the management of public money. We have to invest public money in a strategic way that doesn't bid public money against public money, and at the same time deliver a return for a national audience across all codes. So there are limitations there. The financial plight that RTE is in since 2008 is well documented and well publicised. So I don't have a bottomless pit of money. And in the good old days, I famously remember when we had a rights suite that included Champions League on both nights, Heineken Cup, as you called out, Six Nations Rugby. We had pretty much outside of the GAA league and club, the full kit and caboodle, and it were great times. But it's before the 2008 crash, and since the 2008 crash, the global landscape has changed, the sporting landscape has changed, and the broadcasting landscape has changed, and that impacts fundamentally across every sport. GAA is no different.
You mentioned a rights issue, and I obviously understand that. So you've got the rights to the championship, not the league. Or not the club, but have you been bidding for the league or the club?
No, because the league and the club are not in play at the moment, because these are contractual.
Did you bid for them before the start of the last contract?
I can't honestly speak for that, because again, in understanding and in trying to explain to people, these are very, very sensitive commercial negotiations that take place between the various different parties, and there are multiple parties involved in terms of the GAA, the sporting organisation, and then the various different partners who are bidding. That's very, very sensitive commercial agreements that are at play, and there are rightly confidentiality clauses that are at play in there too, because of the nature of the agreement. So the truth is, I know what's in play now. What was in play prior to the 1st of June this year. There's much of it that I don't know, and there's much of it that is basically faded away into history now. So I can account from the 1st of June onwards. Prior to that, it's trickier.
Okay, and just on the budget, like, I mean, is that something that's improving within RT? Are your hands going to be tied? So since 2008. Are things turning around where you're going to see more money being freed up? Maybe when it comes, I know it's not for another 4 years before all the rights are up
three,
again.
Yeah, this is the end of year. The end of year two out of a 5 year cycle on this. So there's three to go.
Are you optimistic that money will be freed up potentially? You know, to get to bid for club or bid for league, for example.
I would like to think so. I think there's a huge commitment and a huge desire within RTE. But equally, like, I mean, and again, this is going to sound slightly political, but here's the context in which we're operating in. Again, it's public. Known in front of all sorts of Oireachtas committees and all sorts of public forums, whereby the evasion rate with regard to the RT licence fee is hugely significant and costs us millions of pounds every year. When I say us, I mean RTE and therefore the public, because that money doesn't come into an RTE pot and get distributed among RTE presenters. It comes into an RTE pot and then goes back out either to the sporting organisations or to the arts and culture community or to the very, you know, the independent production sector who provide the programmes back into RTE. Commercially, everybody's aware of the situation. It's the same for Joe, it's the same for the national newspaper industry, it's the same for anybody who's dealing in advertising. You see the Amazons and the Googles and the Facebooks of the world swallowing up the advertising, and commercially it's very, very difficult. So can I sit here hand on heart and say there's going to be more money in 3 years' time when we come back around again? No. Can I say that there is an absolute desire to have as much money available for sporting rights as we can? Yeah, absolutely.
Colin O'Rourke said in his piece there just on Sunday, I was reading it, that RT have been frozen out of the club market. Like, what did he mean by that, or do you understand it?
I don't know, is the honest answer. Colm hasn't said that to me, but Colm's like ourselves. He comes from a GAA background. He wants to see as much club action there as possible. TG Cahir do a fantastic job on the club. Ayr have been doing a great job on the club. So there's a desire on all parts to for RTE to show more of the club action. But in terms of frozen out, you know, if you've got, let's use makey uppy figures here, if you've got 100 quid and you have to cover everything, and that 100 quid through a drop in commercial revenue and as a result of licence fee not coming in drops down to 80 quid, then my proportion of it in terms of the sport budget is likely to drop as well, and then you've got to decide and you've got to make choices. And it's
you're trying to plead with the nation to pay their licence fee.
I'm not trying
mine's paid up to date, fully up to date.
I'm not trying to plead with anybody, but I'm trying to put in context the nature of the environment that we find ourselves in. As I say, like, I mean,
well, it is a better environment getting a licence fee and commercial revenue, say, than others. You are in a much stronger position than others.
And equally, I'm not trying to play the poor mouth here. I'm trying to put a context in terms of where we're at, because RTE is all things to all people, as it should be the national broadcaster. I've spent 19 years in RTE. I believe that RTE is news, sport, and major events. And those major events extend from everything from President Obama coming to the country, to the Queen coming to the country, to the Pope coming to the country, to Storm Ophelia, Storm Emma, the 8th referendum, and all that kind of stuff. News and current affairs is an expensive business. Sports rights now, because of rights inflation, is an expensive business. We also have a remit with regard to drama, arts and culture, Irish language, music and entertainment, across the board.
It's huge,
if the pie drops, then sport takes a hit in that. And we've seen that. Like, you know, again, it's a matter of public record. We've lost a number of sporting contracts. That's not down to any one individual, any one department, or any lack of willingness. It's down to a financial market and a fractured market, which takes me back to the point whereby sporting organisations, including the GAA, have a decision to make: revenue, exposure. That's the decision for them, and that's a critical decision. And I understand both sides of the coin. Trust me, I do. And if I was in the GAA side, I'd say maximise the revenue, but maximise the exposure. And striking the balance between those two is very, very difficult.
I think the golf is moving back, isn't it? Or is it moving back to BBC again for more exposure rather than the subscription channels where, like, I mean, will you get as good the same level of sponsorship if less people are watching it? You know, so there is that balance, obviously.
That's the balance. That's the balance. Like, it wasn't the last major in the US, the first one not to be shown on linear TV.
It went back,
So, you know, you could watch it on the app or you could watch it wherever. But that's just a further indication as to how far the market is splintered and how many players are in the market, and some of them are backed by, be it hedge funds or otherwise, which whereby they'll gamble with money. Ours is public money, and we're very lucky to get it. You're right, we have a commercial model, we have a license fee model, but the pie is shrinking, and the demands are still the same, and that's difficult. And as head of sport, I have to be cognizant of that, I have to be aware of it, I have to fight the corner, which is what my department would expect me to do and what people expect me to do, and then I have to, like, let me give you one example. The hockey team, the women's hockey team this year, fabulous achievement, getting to a World Cup final, and we were lucky enough through negotiation with the head of TV Sport, Cliona O'Leary, did a great job in securing those rights for us, and that became part, we were part of almost a national desire to embrace this team because they were brilliant, they exceeded all expectations, they were female, which would have had a particular resonance as well, and they exceeded all expectations, and they did it with a smile on their face. We have to bid for those rights. And getting in on the back of those rates creates for us a national momentum and helps the sporting federation. So everything that goes to hockey, everything that goes to gymnastics, everything that goes to the European Championships, that's all part of the same pool.
Yeah. Another thing Colm O'Rourke mentioned in his piece, and it's something I've said on the podcast a good bit, is that the provincial club championships that are going to be coming up in October and November, they're huge, they're correct, brilliant, they're exciting.
Yeah.
I'd love to see a Sunday game that night after that. You know, are highlights rights decided for that? Because no one shows, that's on TG4 on the Monday night, that's exclusive and there's no one else.
Yeah. Again,
can you get in there on that?
Well, you see, this is tricky for me, Colm, and I'm not trying to be coy with you, but I'm trying to explain. There's a rights agreement in place with regard to these various different championships. We have the highlights for the Sunday game. Others hold the rights for
only
other
for
nights.
Championship. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that makes it very, very difficult for everybody. But yeah, look, I remember a classic game back in the early 80s between Scotstown and Devonish in Clontibret on a really, really wet day. It was a horrible day. I remember going up and watching Enda Muldoon playing for Ballanderry probably 15, 20 years ago, and he put on an absolute exhibition in the Ulster Championship. They're great games. Everybody loves them. Everybody would love to have more exposure. Certainly, I'd love to have more exposure at that time of the year. You look at the club, like the club is at the very heart of what the GAA is.
It's getting bigger though. It's getting much bigger, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's great to see. Look at Coola coming out and effectively out of nowhere in the last 2 years and winning the All-Ireland. You know, I live in South Armagh. Cross Madlen are only up the road. You know, you think of the greats in the club game. You're thinking Cross, you're thinking Nemo, you're thinking of clubs like that. I have a great appreciation for the club. It's where I came from. I wasn't good enough to play county at the highest level, but I believe in the club. But again, you know, at the risk of sounding slightly repetitive here, small amount of money, rights negotiation, everything tied up, 3-year deal, it becomes very, very difficult.
Yeah, no, it definitely does. I want to move on to pundits here with you because you had some interesting things to say. You said about your pundits, they can be critical of formats, structures, tactics and systems, but they cannot be critical in a personalised way of individuals. I've no time for, nor will I tolerate, personal attacks on individuals.
Yeah.
What would you describe as a personal attack?
Something that's not either information-based or informed opinion. So the example that I've stated on numerous occasions is, and I'm not going to name names here because it would be...
Brawley and Kavanagh.
Pardon?
Brawley and Sean
no,
Kavanagh.
No, 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 no. I wasn't talking about pundits. What, oh. what I was talking about is if you want to tell me, or if a pundit wants to come on, or an analyst or a co-commentator comes on an RTÉ platform and says, I don't think that manager is good enough to win an All-Ireland with that team because they've conceded 11 goals in the course of the league. They are defensively suspect, and if you look at the other three teams in the division or the other three teams left in the semi-finals, they've conceded one goal, two goals and four goals. Then I think that's a perfectly legitimate criticism, yeah, because it's informed and there's a degree of fact behind it. If somebody wants to go off and say that the same manager is, and I'm trying to pick my words carefully here, is a clown or doesn't know what he's doing, that's not informed, and there's no fact behind that. You know, the individual, be it hurling or football, is evidently not a clown. He's been appointed on the basis that he or she is the best person for that job. They've taken the team to a certain level. Their record may indicate that they've actually significantly achieved and in some cases overachieved. Yeah. So there are three criteria in my head to get a seat on an RTÉ panel. And I'm happy to go through those if you want. There's three criteria to get through. Number one, you have to have credibility. So you have to have some form of record behind you that says this individual, male or female, is absolutely credible. Number two, you have to have an informed opinion that elevates you above what I'm going to hear in the pub or the terrace or something like that. That you're bringing something that either informs or educates the audience that is watching. And number three, you have to have the ability to articulate that opinion. And what I mean by that are, you work in a broadcast environment, many people who don't won't understand this. In some cases you may get 20 seconds or 30 seconds to form the point that you have to make. You have to have the ability to do that. So there are a lot of people around the country who are very, very knowledgeable, but you put them in a broadcast environment, either radio, television or online, and ask them to articulate their point in 30 seconds, and with lights on them, with cameras on them, filled with and somebody screaming in their ear, we're going to an ad break, and it becomes very difficult for them.
Yeah.
So they're the three criteria that I set in order to get what I call a chair on an RTÉ panel. Once you get that chair, there are then, and this sounds slightly formulaic, but there are two further criteria that I set out that have to be adhered to. One is that you give an informed opinion as opposed to an opinion for opinion's sake that you think is going to grab headlines. It's an informed opinion. Or secondly, that it's information-based analysis. So again, if you can tell me the manager has presided over a team that has conceded three goals in the National Football League and are likely to do well, or the manager has conceded 12 goals over the course of games, then defensively you've got to ask questions about that team. So information based analysis or informed opinion.
Right.
That's the point that I was making. Okay. And that doesn't involve the personal. So one of the things that we've done this year is people like Lee Keegan and Michael Murphy were introduced into the Sunday game once their team had been knocked out of the championship. Yeah. Right?
And was that on your recommendation, or just being done?
Recommendations probably. I have a very, very good, what I consider to be a very, very good, and what many people consider to be a very, very good GAA team who manage the championship. We will bounce ideas off each other. I'm the head of sport, therefore I reserve the right to give my opinion, and then I let them get on with their job. But it's something that I wanted to see, because again, you'll see from that article that the interview that I gave to Gaelic Life, I said about there were 13 analysts across our GAA coverage on the first Sunday that I took over. They were all male and they averaged at 53.
Yeah, now, that's too old. Yeah.
Well, hang on a second. This is not an age thing, Colm, and this has either been misinterpreted or in some cases misrepresented. There is a balance to be struck. I was at the best game in many sense that I was at this year was the Monaghan Kerry game in Clonus, and I look around the crowd that's in front of me. It's not 53-year-old men. There are all sorts of demographics there. There are all sorts of people there from various different backgrounds. And the point I was making, and that was interpreted in some quarters as being ageist. The point that I make is it's got nothing to do with age, because you bring somebody with age, expertise, experience,
yeah, but it also
comes through. So yeah. Michael Murphy and Lee Keegan are representative of a younger generation who are playing the game at the moment. And they form the perfect foil with the older generation who have seen the evolution of the game, going back to the team, the greatest team, the four in a row team, what was previously the greatest team in my lifetime of Kerry, now to the four in the row team. So
I'm just wondering why it took until this year to figure this out, you know, because like, I mean, it's very obvious to me that having three men of a similar generation on a panel wasn't representative of the modern game, and it often fell into with O'Rourke, Brolly and Spillane, why I like all three of them. It got very repetitive, and often Michael Lester's first question to them would be, did you enjoy that? And then they would get into it got very repetitive, the same analysis of, I didn't enjoy it. And while a lot of people would be of the same opinion often, and I share their philosophy on the game, and I don't like a lot of the games, it just got samey. It got so samey that it was like, Jesus, they're not off on this again.
Well, okay, that's your interpretation of it, and like Michael has been and is a brilliant broadcaster.
Yeah,
brilliant
I want to be respectful of Michael.
Yeah, and he did his job brilliantly, and we'll be sorry to see him go. Although Joanne will be a more than able replacement and a brilliant presenter in her own right when she comes along. But the three lads, you see, again, this should not and will not be interpreted as being ageist. The three lads all have credibility. They all have an informed opinion, and they all have the ability to articulate that opinion. Now, the very nature of panellists are, they're subjective. Some will be like Marmite. People will love one individual and not be as keen on others. What I have said is, across the board, going back to that first Sunday in terms of the 13 and the average age of 53, is I want a representative balance. And let me give you Cora Staunton, for example, who we've used on radio a lot this year. Is Cora credible? Absolutely. Does she have an informed opinion? Absolutely. I sat in the car in the car park after the Galway Mayo game this year in Castlebar, and Cora was on with Marty Morrissey, and Cora said, in terms of Mayo today, they had no forwards, they had no leaders, they had poor discipline, they found one player in the league who was a defender, and we don't need defenders, we need forwards, and they weren't up to standard today. And she did that in 20 seconds. So I sat there and I went, now, there's somebody who needs to be heard and should be given a national platform in order to articulate her views, because credible, informed opinion, information-based analysis, and the ability to articulate it. The other side of it is, quite frankly, I've got a 9-year-old daughter who plays Gaelic football. She needs to have role models. She needs to be able to see that the Sinead Aherns, the Caroline O'Hanlons, the Cora Stauntons that are in Crow Park, the Anya Sullivans, whoever it is, that she can aspire to that level. And if I go back to the game in Clonus, where I was sitting at the Kerry Monaghan game, there are women around me. They play the game. They coach the game. They coach their youngsters. They bring them along. Their opinion, provided it's credible, informed, and ability to articulate it, is just as valid as somebody else's. Now, they may not all have the record of All Ireland medals and Celtic crosses in their back pocket, but it doesn't mean they're not representative. And as you know, Gaelic games across its various different codes is something that everybody needs to embrace. Record crowd for the ladies' final last Sunday. This is a game that's growing. So I don't. It doesn't mean that you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater when you say they're all men and they're 53. It means that you're striking for balance that makes it representative to the entire audience.
Yeah.
And that to me is important as the national broadcaster, that we represent that. But like the ageist argument, I quote people like Donal Lenehan in rugby, our best rugby analyst by a country mile. Now, I met Donal in the office yesterday. Donal would be the first to admit he's not in the 20 or 30 bracket, but he's absolutely brilliant. So it's nothing to do with age. It's about striking the balance.
It's about different age profiles on the same panel. Yeah, maybe like that. Is it difficult to strike the balance between having an entertaining panel and doing analysis? Because from a lot of people would see RTE as being entertaining, but light on analysis, and say Sky is too much analysis and very little debate or entertainment.
You answered your own question in terms of the balance. If one is entertaining and the other is overly analytical, where's the balance in between?
Yeah.
But again, like, an awful lot of this is based on time. And I'll put that in the context of two things. A live game, you may be going from a 2 o'clock game that finishes at 2:35 with three ad breaks to go, trying to do a build up to a 4 o'clock game. So in total, the analyst may have 5 or 6 minutes to both inform inform, engage, entertain, yeah, and analyse. And then you go to the nighttime programme, and here's, to go back to your highlights programme, here's one of the biggest problems that we face in RTE, particularly in a Sunday game context. We could have 15 games to get through, and maybe along with maybe Camogie, depending on the time of year and depending on qualifiers, that could be 17 games. On another night you could have 3 games. So if you want to do analysis, you know, and give the scope and give the depth, when I talked earlier on about the 10% of criticism that I think is perfectly legitimate, I'll tell you part of the reason where I'm coming from there. If you're from the so-called weaker counties or the so-called lesser counties, right, in the structures that we currently have, and your team goes out and plays the championship and you see 2 minutes of it on the Sunday game that night, you get extremely frustrated.
Yeah.
Part of the problem is we've got 90 minutes to cover 17 games 1 week, we've got 90 minutes to cover 15 games the next week, and we've got 90 minutes to cover 3 games the following week.
Just to pull you up on that though, and that's where a lot of the frustration is that you have 90 minutes to cover those games, and that's not easy.
Yeah.
But you spend most of it covering the 2 games that were on the television earlier on that day. So, like, I mean,
which
you're
are
losing,
invariably the big games.
But GAA fans will have seen them, you know, they, and they're on the player, so you can go see them if you're really passionate, you want to see them, they're there.
Yeah.
But instead of spending all that, like, the amount of frustration you would have after sitting at home watching the 2 matches, and then you're back on saying, geez, there was an example this year of Longford had beaten Meath, Carlow had beaten Kildare.
Yeah.
There was 2 big hurling games that day.
Yeah.
They were both on RTE, they were both on Radio 1, and then the Sunday game starts with extended highlights of them. And you, we're all seeing on Twitter, Jesus, Carlow have just beaten Kildare, Longford have beaten Meath, that's unbelievable. And then we're like, surely that's a night where you might go with the lesser counties and go, Hurling's had its had a big.
Okay, well,
you know,
I wouldn't be governed too much by Twitter for a start.
No, but
I take your point in general. Second thing about it is there are logistical concerns around this that sometimes have to be balanced by editorial on many levels. If we had a multi-camera OB at the Carlow game, of course we would lead off with the Carlow game. But here's the reality of the situation that we find ourselves in. In many cases, we could have a full OB on the 2 live hurling matches of the day. So you've got multi-cameras, anything from 9 to 11 to 13 to 15, depending on the time of year. Okay, with the Carlow game at the qualifiers, you could have a mini OB with 3 to 4 cameras, or you could have a single camera OB.
Yeah.
Now, a single camera OB is not what you're going to lead off the 9 o'clock news for, because it becomes very difficult. So editorially, I take your point. Yeah. You'd love to see something different. But it's not as simplistic as that, because
that's
you've
a
got
budget issue then again, isn't it?
You've got to get the balance. Yeah, it's partly a budget issue, but it's also, like, I mean, there's a reason why the 2 big games are the 2 big games of the day. They're also likely to provide, in many cases, the main talking points of the day, and they deserve a degree of analysis. And arguably this year, no, not arguably, certainly this year, the hurling championship went to a whole new level.
Yeah.
So the level of analysis that was required to explain why we had the summer of hurling that we have and what made it the summer is perfectly legit. Now, if you're from, to use your example, Carlow or one of the other counties, of course you want to see more. But what you've got to understand is, to go back to the point, on some Sundays this year we've had 3 games to analyse. On other Sundays we've had 17 games to analyse. There's an imbalance there. The season, as you well know, and I don't have to tell you, has been concertina.
Yeah.
It's gone to 4 months. So the other criticism of us this year was that there were games that weren't seen, particularly the Monaghan-Tyrone game, the first game that ended up as an absolute classic, with a wonder score from Conor McManus.
You hadn't taken over by then, that's very obvious. That never would have happened,
but why didn't we see that? Well, the reality was that we had tough choices to make, and they were made, you're right, they were made in advance of me taking over, but there were 2 brilliant hurling matches on that day.
Did you push the GAA at the start of the year? Because did you remember Tom Ryan came out at the start of the year and says, we're happy with the agreement that we had last year? And I was thinking, what kind of a ridiculous thing is that to say when we've got way more games? How can you be happy with last year when it's just not the same? You're not playing with the same hand. Were you pushing them to get more games? And, like, you know, you had obviously the agreement, but that's not, the agreement you had is not what we have. You know what I mean? What you had this year.
Okay, so the agreement that we have, the rights contract that we have, predated the change in the structures. And the agreement that was made in terms of verbal agreement would be that there would be a review at the end of this year to see how it worked. Because there are a multitude of issues that have arisen this year for Croke Park, for the fixtures committee, for the broadcasters, etc., etc. So in the next couple of weeks, we will sit down with Croke Park and go, okay, what were the issues for you? What were the issues for you? This year was, in many regards, a finding your feet scenario, because the hurling format changed and the Super 8s came in. And it was basically throw everything up in the air to a degree and let's see how this year plays itself out. Now, I think if we were to be back here in 12 months' time, we would probably see some changes, but it's been a learning curve for all of us, in the sense that, you know, the Newbridge issue, the provincial winners not getting home advantage in the first round of the Super 8s, the Croke Park games for Super 8s, whereby the beauty of Croke Park is, you know, it's the theatre of dreams in a GAA context. The problem for Croke Park is you put 50,000 people in it, you don't see the 50,000 that are there, you see the 32,000 that are not there. So there's an issue there. Yeah. So at the end of this season, in the next couple of weeks, we'll have that review
and talk to me. Can I just pull you up on the package reports? Yeah. Right, so
pull me up.
Well, I was at the Laois Wexford game, a live game down in Wexford Park, and it went to extra time. Brilliant comeback by Laois.
Right,
the package, it was 90 minutes in total between extra time, injury time, the whole lot. Unbelievable drama and excitement.
Yeah.
The package was 2:27. Now, I understand that, like, on match of the day or something, it's very easy to get everything in because very little happens in soccer, and that's much easier. So it's difficult in GAA to get all the highlights into that. But, like, I mean, I remember thinking, I got no flavour of what actually happened on that day.
I don't remember the game specifically, but was it a Saturday or Sunday?
It was a Saturday evening game.
Okay, qualifier? Now,
it was a quarterfinal of the Leinster Championship.
Okay, so it
was. But the thing about it was, and I was thinking, geez, the Sunday game could actually lead off with this. It was that good.
Yeah.
Now, there was only one camera at the game, and the camera was set up. There's a terrace on one side, and it was just on the top of that terrace. It wasn't even mounted up high, so it was almost like at standing level.
Yeah.
And I was thinking to myself, and I hope you don't take this the wrong way.
Go ahead.
But I was thinking, like, you're the national broadcaster with exclusive rights to this championship.
Yeah.
And this is the best that we can get as viewers. One camera on top of a terrace. Like, I mean, that's an exclusive. No one else. Like, if the budget is that tight.
Yeah.
Like, I thought that was seriously shortchanging people for a Leinster quarter final.
Okay. So, again, let me ask you a question. Give me an idea of how much you think it is to put an OB, an outside broadcast unit, in to give due cognizance and recognition to a game of that status.
I would have no idea.
Exactly. So this is my point.
But my point is that if the budget is that tight, why have you got national rights? Would it be better off if you maybe had half those rights and put everything into it so that you can give a proper kind of reflection and let someone else in that might actually have some budget? Do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, if it's gone that thin, then why have you got exclusive rights if there's only one camera at a Leinster quarterfinal?
Okay, well, and I'm sure you'll be happy to put the same criticism to others who don't turn up in the Ockhams, don't turn up in the own begs, don't turn up in Navan at times. Because, look, there is a finite number of outside broadcast companies who are out there, and one of the points of the review this year actually will be for both Sky as the other broadcaster in the championship and ourselves, is given the number of games concertinaed into such a tight season, particularly when we went to replays this year, it was virtually nigh on impossible to get enough staffing to do the OB units. So it's not as if, you know, there's 10 OB units sitting out there and RTE won't pay for them. In many cases, the staffing levels are such that we have to cover 17 games. 17 games could involve 50 plus cameras.
Yeah.
That's 50 plus people. That's 50 plus wages. Like, the budget is it's never used as an excuse, it's used as an explanation. So I can understand the frustration of people who say there was only one camera and there was only 2.5 minutes, but it's on a game, on a weekend, when there could be 15, 17, 18 matches, many of which are in different locations, many of which, to go back to your point on the terraces, turn up at grounds that don't have media facilities. And you've seen this yourself, whereby you don't have broadcast facilities, you don't have towers, you don't have an elevated position. Now, many of the grounds are fantastic, let's not take away from them, but depending on the ground that you're operating in, I've gone to grounds in years gone by were by those huge big girders. And again, this is not unique to the GAA. I was at a soccer ground 2 weeks ago and I was in the stand and my view was blocked on both sides. I couldn't see it. And this is a serious team in soccer.
Can you see the TV rights going a little bit like the radio rights? Because I remember when we were in News Talk, obviously you were the main radio rights holder, so you got the best game and then we took the game that you didn't want. Mm. Like, for example, if it came to a situation where you couldn't stretch to send a full OB crew down to Wexford Park, that would be like a third choice game and somebody, you know what I mean, somebody else could come in, or is that, that's
ultimately a decision for the GAA.
Yeah, it's more of a GAA decision.
It's ultimately a decision for the GAA. Like, I mean, the GAA come in, they put their contractual obligations on the table, everybody bids, and it takes from there.
Yeah, it's done different than radio though, isn't it? It's like exclusive and you have it there.
Well, it's the TV rights are no longer exclusive because Sky obviously have their games.
Yeah. Just on the highlights rights, because I have a lot of sympathy for the Sunday game. Like, 17 games is absolute madness and there's no solution for this. Like, I mean, it's just not possible to give people what they want. Under the current agreement.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, if you get highlights rights for Monday night and Wednesday night, so you could, on the Wednesday night, for example, you could analyse the two big games that are on television. You could show football on Sunday night and hurling on Monday night and alternate them.
Yeah.
Obviously, everybody knows, well, maybe not everybody knows, but you don't have the rights outside of Sunday night.
Correct.
Which, I've contacted Croke Park because this really frustrates me.
Right.
Why would the GAA curtail highlights rights? Why would they, like, I've actually said this to them, I won't say who I said it to. Why would every different broadcaster not get the highlights rights and do what you can with them and let's have lots of different shows, see who's, you know, who's doing a good job on it? Why, like, Sky do nothing with their highlights, which is completely out of order. TG4 do a little bit on a Monday and you're stuck with Sunday. No, like, we would love to do a highlight show. We can't do them. Like, I think that's so restrictive and it doesn't promote the game. And I think the GAA are shooting themselves in the foot. And I'm just wondering, is this something you will go back as the main rights holder and demand and say, look, Jesus, what do you want here? Do you want to promote these games? We want to do more shows. Yeah. We're stuck on a Sunday night.
Yeah.
Let's rip up that part of it and let's... Okay.
Well, look, I mean, I'm not trying to be difficult on your language here, but number one, we don't go and make demands of anybody. Number two, we're not talking about ripping up legally binding contracts. But in general, I absolutely take your point. Would we love to show more? Yes. Like, we are in the evolution of a process that, if you go back a number of years ago, the rights agreements were fundamentally different. Croke Park, to their credit, and I will give them absolute credit on this, have done a phenomenal job with regard to their rights in terms of certain specifics, including maximising the revenue from there, which allows them to reinvest in the clubs, which allows them to build stadiums, which allows them to plough it back into the grassroots. I absolutely get that. But Croke Park, along with every other organisation, at a point have to make a decision between revenue and exposure. Okay? Yeah. So,
but sorry, just cut you off there. If they sold the highlights rights to more than just three, sure, they will make more revenue.
But that's it. But
they won't. They'll get less from the three, but they'll get more from other places.
Okay, but that's a decision for Croke Park. Yeah. That's not a decision for me as head of sport. But let me explain my point to you, right? I have a 5-year-old son and a 10-year-old son, okay? And I'll give you two examples as to what I'm talking about. After the Monaghan-Kerry game that I've now referred to three times, I came out of Clonus and Marty Morrissey was doing the Marty squad from the Roadcaster. And standing at the Marty squad was Jack O'Shea and Nudie Hughes, ready to be interviewed by Marty, right? And I was there and I pointed to my son and I said, James, that's Jack O'Shea. That's one of the greatest players ever to play the game. He's an absolute legend. He was brilliant and he's from Kerry. And without missing a beat, my 10-year-old son said, well, but what about the Gooch? And I said, yeah, the Gooch was brilliant and he was a brilliant player, but Jack was a different player and Jack was like the Gooch to me. The point that I was making was that, and it goes back to what we were talking about earlier on, every generation needs its heroes. To me, Jack O'Shea's goal in 81 and what Jack O'Shea did and that team with, you know, Ogie and Ger Power and Mikey Sheehy and Pat Spillane, absolute legends. To my 10-year-old son, Gooch is the legend. Stephen Cluxton is the legend. Dean Rock, you know, Kieran Kilkenny. These are the heroes of today. My 5-year-old son goes around the house singing the Mo Salah song. He knows who Aubameyang is and he knows that Giroud now plays for Chelsea and used to play for Arsenal and he's 5 years old. Okay? Now you take Tian Lynch, Aaron Gillan, Patrick Horgan, Seamus Harnedy, any of those players, take them outside of their county and tell me how many of the kids at 5 or 10 years of age will recognise those individuals. So that's my argument with regard to revenue and exposure. By all means, absolutely exploit the revenue to the maximum because you're reinvesting it. But the exposure argument is that my 5-year-old should know, beyond Conor McManus and beyond Dean Rock and beyond you know, all the other players that you can think of, but the exposure to make heroes for the next generation, because please God, in 30 or 40 years time, my now 10-year-old will stand with his son or his daughter and say, that's the Gooch Cooper. But Dad, he's not, you know, Sean White or whoever the new hero is for him.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm talking about in terms of exposure. That we take these guys and we give them maximum exposure on a national broadcaster, and not in any way taken away from Sky, not in any way taken away from TG Cahir. But we make Aubameyangs and Giroud's and Mo Salah's and Bobby Firmino's. Like Bobby Firmino on Tuesday night, scoring in the last minute. David Clifford scoring in the last minute. That's the fourth time I've referred to that kid. with 7 men between him and the far corner when he hit the ball. Brilliant photo in the Irish Times the next day.
Yeah.
7 men. The 2 Hugheses, the 2 Wileys, Carl O'Connell, Rory Began and Desi Moan. 7 between when Starr knocked it down to him, when Clifford got the ball. There were 7 men between him and the far corner and he found it. That's the genius of David Clifford, off both feet. You know, most players couldn't hit that shot because they'd be, you know, it wouldn't be on their right side. That's the genius of David Clifford. So in the same way I talk about Jacko and my 10-year-old talks about the Gooch, the next, my 5-year-old will talk about David Clifford in years to come as the genius that he, please God, will turn out to be.
Yeah.
And that's the difference between revenue and exposure. By all means, get the revenue, but also expose these guys in the best possible sense. Not exploit, expose.
Yeah.
So that they become heroes for the next generation.
Is an issue with the highlights rights that RTE, TG4 and Sky have, I'm right saying Sunday, Monday and Wednesday, or Sunday, Monday, Saturday, I think AIR might have Wednesday, whatever the deal is, but all you broadcasters that have the highlights rights on that night want exclusivity on that night. So that's where the flexibility is kind of, you know, under pressure, really, with the highlights rights.
You're not entirely correct, but for reasons of confidentiality, I'm not going to necessarily correct you, but it's more complex than that. But also, I wasn't involved in the negotiation of the last contract, so I can't tell you that RTE went in and demanded exclusivity. I sincerely doubt it, quite frankly. But there was a model drawn up, okay? And that's the model that we currently have. Would I like to see the current model changed? Yes. But there's a contract in place. Next time round, when the contract's up for negotiation, I think there'll be a different set of arguments. But currently, it's difficult because there are certain constraints there within the current rights agreement.
Okay. Just to finish up, In 3 years' time, you're going to, hopefully, you'll be still head of sport in RTE. Everything will be going well. What's your ideal scenario realistically? You know, like, what will RTE have that would be on your list with GAA, obviously?
Okay, specifically with GAA, but again, I have to say, like, you know, it sounds slightly political, but everything has a context. I'm the head of sport, so we have all the significant soccer qualifiers for the Euros and the World Cup. We've the next Olympics in Tokyo, we've the next Euros, and we've the next World Cup. There are people who have emerged this year, like the hockey people and like Reece McLellan in the gymnastics, who are equally deserving of national exposure, and the rowers that we saw at the weekend, national moments on a national broadcaster. So I have to be head of sport across the board. But if you want my scenario with regard to GAA, it's that we are sufficiently well funded in order to reinvest the funds into sports rights to broaden our portfolio across the GAA season, so we have a seasonal footprint in order to create the David Clifford, create sounds because we've no role in creating David Clifford, in order to allow for the exposure that the David Cliffords of today and the Aaron Gillans and those guys deserve, so that they're coming through. So that you'd have a year round
seasonal footprint.
That's what I call it, a seasonal footprint.
With improved highlights rights, potentially.
A seasonal footprint across the board.
Okay.
Across the board. Like, you know, do we need.
I think that's what everybody wants. I think.
think that's what everybody wants.
Yeah, and I'm sure over the course of time everybody can work towards that. But there is a balance for the broadcasters to be struck between the demands that are on their funds and what they have available to them, and there's a demand to be struck between for the sporting federations across the board, including Croke Park, between revenue and exposure. And that's the point that I kind of beat the drum about. By all means extract, but also allow for the fact that we need to create the heroes of tomorrow. I was in Geneva last week when you phoned me about this interview, and I listened to Sebastian Coe because he was talking about the Athletics Federation, and he said we will live or die. Because athletics are slightly concerned that Usain Bolt and Mo Farah, as the two global superstars, are fading off the thing, and every generation brings along. Seb Coe said, "We will live or die by our ability to attract the next generation." Okay? So for the next generation, again, Jack O'Shea, Gooch Cooper, David Clifford, you know, Barney Rock, Dean Rock, and the next Dublin player that comes along, you know, go back to the great Galway team of the 60s, then you've got Michael Donlan and Pádraig Joyce, and you've Shane Walsh and Damien Comer coming now. It's about creating for each generation these guys, and I've obviously picked the footballers there. In Cork you can go to the Kevin Hennessy's and the John Fenton team, right through to the Donalogue Rock team, and now through to the Seamus Harmony team, you know. So I think there's an onus on us, Colm, and I think there's a what's the word I'm looking for? There's an onus and an expectation, and there's something in our DNA, particularly as the national broadcaster, and I don't take away from Joe or the national newspapers or anybody else. There's an onus on us to have the game that we have, and we don't create the heroes, but we show the heroes do what they do. So if there's going to be a Messi and there's going to be a Ronaldo and there's going to be a Zidane, then equally in an Irish context, there's going to be whoever you want to pick, a Jimmy Keaveney from the 70s through to a Joe Connolly as the captain of the Galway team, right through that these moments, the Anthony Daly's, the Seamus Darby's. You think of Croke Park, you think of the moments in Croke Park, you know, but whether it's Joe McDonough singing Joe Connolly's speech, Anthony Daly lifting the trophy, go to Armagh 02, I was there, go to Tyrone in 03, Wexford in 96, you know, Clare back in 97. You see what it does for a county. And the thing that I keep telling people is, in all the stats that are thrown around, there is no device that will measure what Limerick did for hurling this year. You know, I can quote you numbers for how many people watched it, how many people listened, all that kind of stuff. There is no device on this planet that can measure what Limerick did for hurling this year and what Limerick did for 5-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 15-year-olds in Limerick, because that social fabric means that there's a desire there on the Sunday night, the Monday night, the Tuesday night, the Wednesday night to go out and lift a hurler, kick a ball or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I believe that RTE have a role in that.
Okay, listen, Declan, I've taken up enough of your time. Thanks very much for coming in.
No problem.
That's all we have time for this week. We'll be back on Monday as usual, so we'll talk to you then. Good luck.
I'm not finished yet. It took me a long time to get here.
Both parents have spoken with each other, and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other, and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
That these fellas will get such a f***ing shell shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their f***ing asses for f***ing 10 years.
The GAA Hour is sponsored by Paddy Power. For exclusive content from their GAA ambassadors and other high-profile contributors, check out news.paddypower.com.